Morning, Your Honors. We're here today. My name is Gerald Hart, law firm of Darrell S. Elliott. Registration number is 1280. 1228, I'm sorry. This is an interpleader action whereby Jerry Mullins was in a impact collision, low impact, minor soft tissue injuries, and he was treated by Dr. Haney in 2005 for several months. And then in 2007, he went back to Dr. Haney after a two-year hiatus, although the appellee says he received treatment for continuously for 2 years, he did not. That one visit, up to that point, the medicals were $6,000. The one visit was over $10,000 for one visit. And MLM claimed they're entitled to that funds also. They suggested we file interpleader when we could not settle with MLM regarding the bill. Interpleader was filed at their suggestion. We claimed there's superior interest in that we're entitled to a course back, and we felt, and Mullins felt, that a $10,000 bill for one visit was quite excessive and had to be proven. So we filed the interpleader action, and we took defaults against ProCare and Metro Imaging, okay? And their defaults against, the only person left was MLM. MLM then filed a counterclaim against Mr. Mullins for $17,000, the entire billing of Dr. Haney, except there was only balance of $8,000 from the PI settlement. Therefore, there were the claim being made against Mr. Mullins personally for amounts over the $8,000, and it was incumbent upon our law firm, Mr. Elliott, to defend Mr. Mullins against that counterclaim. We amended the complaint, and the counterclaim was not reasserted, it was dropped. And we mentioned that to Judge Samour, and Judge Samour said there's no case law on that, yet there is. So we have a dropped counterclaim, and yet we proceeded forward because the judge...
When did you mention that to the judge?
Excuse me?
When did you mention that to the judge? At what point in the procedure, in the process?
I think at trial, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the court said there is no case law. In his order, too, June 2nd, he said there's no case law requiring a reassertion of the counterclaim after the complaint is amended. And there is.
What was the difference in time from when you filed your amended complaint and they filed their amended answer without adding the counterclaims to the time of trial?
Maybe a year.
And did you mention anything between that time?
No, I didn't.
Did you litigate the counterclaims? Did you defend them?
Against my opposition, we litigated. Yes, sir.
How come you didn't mention anything from the time that it first came up until the time of trial?
There was no reason to, because we assumed the counterclaim was dead.
Well, you were litigating it.
Well, we're litigating a lot of issues, Your Honor. There was a motion filed for summary judgment that was late, and a 6B1 motion was not filed before the due date, and the 6B2 motion was not filed, even after I told Mr. Muggy the motion was late, tardy. And we asserted to the judge, we said, Judge, there's no jurisdiction, although it should have been no authority, because there's a case in the federal system that says a motion for summary judgment filed late, the court does not have authority to render an opinion regarding that motion. But we still move forward. Attached to the motion for summary judgment were exhibits that were never identified in their disclosure. And Rule 37C says if you don't identify documents in your disclosures, you can't use them in a motion for summary judgment or trial. Didn't go anywhere. We have a motion for summary judgment. There was no affidavits of any witness or any exhibit to justify its introduction in evidence on motion for summary judgment. So when I brought that to Mr. Muggy's attention, he himself filed an affidavit saying that all exhibits that we produced were 750 pages. They're all true and correct, and therefore should be admissible in the motion for summary judgment. Then after that, he realized, I never seen an affidavit that seemed to be a frivolous affidavit where an attorney takes a personal interest in the case to say the records are a notarizer would be introduced to trial. I've never seen it. So in an effort to correct that, Mr. Muggy says, well, there's a federal case that says you not have notarized exhibits. But rule one of our rules of procedure say these rules govern motion for summary judgment in a state court, not federal court. And he said in his brief, well, we looked for guidance to the federal system if there's nothing available in the state court. Well, there is. There's a rule that says on 56C, you must affidavits, depositions, interrogatories, and request submissions. They can be allowable in the motion for summary judgment. There was none. So the judge denied the motion for summary judgment, went to trial. Around April 2010, realizing that I had to file a 26A2, I waived the claim of Mr. Muggy because it would be excessively expensive to hire a doctor to come in and testify that the $10,000 bill was not reasonable. Although Dr. Landon, the doctor from the Farrell case, which is the prior lawsuit, came out and said the bill of $10,000 was excessive, but to bring him to trial would be $2,000-$3,000. So we waived off, shifting the burden of proof to the counterclaimant, as they had to prove that the bill was reasonable. And we started trial, and we agreed at the trial that the issues to be presented before the court would be reasonable and necessity of the medical bills, all of them, because there was a counterclaim for $17,000, not for $10,000, not for $6,000. The entire amount was a counterclaim.
Mr. Hart, excuse me for interrupting. At the trial, didn't Mr. Dampier testify that the medical bills were reasonable?
Yes, but here's the problem. Mr. Muggy never filed a 26A2 as required by the statute rule, nor did he file a witness list, a non-extra witness, stating with particularity what the witness would say in trial. I had no idea when the trial started what Mr. Dampier was going to testify to. And we cited in our brief that necessity can only come from medical doctor. Well, it's reasonless. And not knowing what Mr. Dampier was going to say, because it was like a trial by ambush. We didn't receive any expert witness. We never received non-expert witness. And we never received exhibits. Nothing.
But wasn't that witness, in fact, somebody that your firm was going to use in the underlying case?
Dampier was from MLM. Nothing to do with me. No, Your Honor. Dampier was the manager, I think, of MLM.
Okay, and
we have no intent of using him to prove their case. No, Your Honor.
You'd never seen his name before. You'd only never seen an affidavit before.
And on disclosures, he said he was going to testify regarding the signing of a lien. That was it. Nothing more. And Dr. Haney was going to come to court to justify signing a lien also. That was all that was on the 26A1 or 16-1K in the simplified procedure. So I had no idea where Mr. Lambert was coming from, not being able to see what his testimony was going to be, not to prepare a cross-examination. So we went to trial I was actually ambushed because I had nothing to cross-examine. One thing, the rule on exhibits say that if you don't object to an exhibit within 14 days, it's deemed admissible. I never got the exhibits until the day of trial, so I couldn't object at all. But the one exhibit, the lien agreement, if that would have been produced to me, I would have objected saying, there's no signature of Dr. Haney on your lien agreement. Therefore, they would have had time to bring Dr. Haney to trial to testify that I did sign the lien, although it's not there, it was signed. But if you look at Exhibit 2, which is attached to the motion for summary judgment, there is no signature of Dr. Haney. So there were four issues.
I thought the existence and validity of the lien was not contested.
Well, they had to prove it, Your Honor. They had to prove their entitlement to collect the monies. And that's why they introduced that lien, to show they were entitled to collect that lien and the amounts they're under. Also, the lien says Dr. Haney shall be consulted before any settlement is made. That never happened either. And we put that in a brief, and there was no response to that issue. So the trial When I was asked whether I spoke to Mr. Mullins during the filing of the interpleader, I said no. I had a brain tumor and I had brain surgery during that period of time. So the judge voided out the whole trial. Mr. Elliott and Todd Bowe had to come to court to testify that they did have permission to file the interpleader. The judge then, on June the 2nd, issued a order stating that he should have granted the summary judgment, but if he's wrong, he should have granted the trial. But if I'm wrong, I should have gotten judicially estoppel, or if I'm wrong, I should have had a breach of contract. So he has four levels where he's trying to show that if he's wrong, maybe something else is right.
Counsel, assuming we agree that the summary judgment motion was late and that a cure for that delay was to grant additional time for full briefing, what would be accomplished by additional summary judgment briefing?
First of all, there was no affidavits at all that were attached to the motion for summary judgment. Nothing. There was not a one affidavit except Mr. Dampier, who testified regarding something else. So the court had no authority, in my opinion, to either grant or deny a motion for summary judgment, as no motion was filed to extend time to file a motion for summary judgment. A 6B2 motion requires excusable neglect, and that was never asserted.
Let me ask you about the trial for a moment. I understand you've got some issues and concerns about some of the discovery issues, and you felt like you were ambushed at the trial.
Yes, sir.
Was the trial otherwise, and the trial judge, I'm assuming, made rulings on the concerns that you're raising today under an abuse of discretion standard. Was the trial otherwise completed from beginning to end? Did both sides get a chance to put their cases on?
Yes, the MLM proved, said to the judge, we're going to prove our case in 15 minutes. And they put on Dampier, who testified, he had no knowledge, when I voir dired him initially, he had no knowledge as to reasonableness of medicals, nor necessity. Necessity can only come from a doctor. Meaning, during that 2-year period, maybe there was another accident, we don't know. But the main concern was that the 26A2 that I filed in the Farrell case was proof of MLM's cause of action as to medical bills. And it was, they alleged that I had a Rule 11 violation. I certified the 26A2 was doctor was going to testify, it was mine. You read it in the thing. But first of all, a 26A2 is not a pleading. It's a witness list, all right, that's number one. The TMO is a witness list and not a damaged end witness and not a pleading. And therefore, they can't prove anything. I've never seen a 26A2 proved at trial medical bill. Number two, the bill of $10,000 was not in existence for 3 weeks until after the 26A2 was filed. So how can anyone say that the 26A2 proves the case when it's not in existence for 3 weeks? I'll reserve my 2 minutes, Your Honor.
Very good. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Zach Muggy, 35821. With me at council table is Michael Davis, 40125. And with us here in attendance today is Daniel Filbert, who is the Vice President of Medical Lien Management. I think your honors just received about a 13-minute glimpse into a case that has unfortunately been going on for 5.5 years now. This case is taken on a life of its own, I think, as you're starting to understand. Before we do anything else, by counsel's own admission at the various hearings, they have not had any contact with the client that they purport to represent here today for 5.5 years. They've had no contact with him since February 2008, yet here we are.
Mr. Muggy, though, isn't it true that Judge Samore reversed his dismissal of the case on that very basis and concluded that the case could go forward?
Two distinct issues, Your Honor. The issue that Judge Samore initially ruled on was that the case, when it was initiated, was void because the attorneys did not have permission to initiate the case. So he reversed himself on that after a hearing in, I think it was 2010, 2012, additional evidence was put on that Mr. Mullins had in fact authorized the initiation of the case. That's one issue. The second, though, which is what I'm speaking about here today, is that even if the attorney sitting here today had permission to initiate the case in 2008, when they lost contact with their client, and when they've had no contact with their client for over 5 years, they had an obligation to withdraw. Well, this is Mr. Mullins' case, not the attorney's.
Mr. Muggy, what relevance does that have to any of the issues raised on appeal?
Because, Your Honor, I think it shows the basis of this whole case is really substantially frivolous, groundless, and vexatious. And I think that's the starting point for these issues.
Well, is that argument that you're just now making about the lack of contact with Mr. Mullins in response to a specific issue raised by Mr. Mullins in his appeal?
Well, not specifically, but I think it's an overarching issue that really is present over this whole case.
Well, so, if it's an overarching issue, then what is your authority to support your statement that the attorneys for Mr. Mullins had an obligation to withdraw when they did not have contact with him?
Well, I think Rule of Professional Conduct 1.4 mandates that an attorney have open dialogue and communication with his client, his or her client. And is it Rule 1.16 that says if you cannot follow these rules, that you need to withdraw? I don't want to take up all the time here today, Your Honor, on this one issue. I'll move on to the specifics.
Well, yes, I would encourage you to do so. But I was just asking those questions because they didn't appear to be relevant to any direct issue that was raised on appeal by Mr. Mullins.
I'll move on to the specifics, Your Honor.
Isn't there a second appeal concerning sanctions or something that's not in front of this division today?
There is, Your Honor.
It seems like that's what you're really talking about.
Yes, I mean, I think they correlate, but I understand the court's points, and I'll move on to the specifics.
I'd be interested in your response to the argument that you didn't file an amendment of your counterclaims, for instance.
Yes, Your Honor. And Judge Samore analyzed that in depth in his June 2nd order. And there's no requirement. Once the counterclaims were initially pleaded by MLM, Mullins filed an answer. It was a very brief answer, but he filed an answer. When the answer was filed, those counterclaims were deemed at issue. Subsequently, Mr. Mullins amended his complaint, and MLM filed an answer to that amended complaint. But there is no requirement that you reallege counterclaims that are already at issue in an answer to an amended pleading filed by someone else.
Mr. Muggy, Judge Samore, as you noted, did say that the amended or that the counterclaim that was filed could stand, but he also noted that there was no Colorado case law on point and that in other jurisdictions there was conflicting case law. Is that correct?
I read that, Your Honor, and I think if you get into the specifics of those cases that were cited, they are distinguishable. Because here, none of those cases, the most important case that the court below cited was this Ground Zero case out of the District of Maryland, and that was directly on point. The other cases that are mentioned don't deal specifically with the issue here, which is the counterclaims were filed, an answer was filed to those counterclaims, and they were at issue. So those other cases, and you know, I don't want to spend all the time going through them, but they are distinguishable on those grounds that it's not specifically at issue. The counterclaims in those cases were not specifically at issue when the amendments took place. So there aren't any Colorado cases directly on point. But I think the rules speak for themselves. Once a claim is deemed at issue, you don't need to refile it. I mean, this is no different than if the counterclaims were filed as an initial claim in a complaint. Once they're answered, you don't have to refile them.
Counsel, was there a trial management order in this case, and that did that trial management order give notice that the counterclaims were at issue?
I don't believe there was a trial management order, Your Honor. This was under simplified procedure. I don't believe there was a trial management order. But the counterclaims were litigated the whole way. So, I mean, this comes as no surprise that these counterclaims were still alive. They were the subject of our motion for summary judgment. They were raised again at trial. So there can be no argument that the counterclaims come as some sort of surprise to Mullins or his counsel.
Okay. And at trial, when you proceeded to try your counterclaims, was there an objection specific to what kind of prejudice the plaintiff would incur if they went forward?
Specifically on the counterclaims, Your Honor?
Yes.
I don't believe there were. Now, there were a number of objections raised, much as the oral argument here today. It was kind of a kitchen sink approach, if you will. So there were numerous objections. I can't tell you specifically on the counterclaims, but there were certainly objections raised to exhibits, to the witness. I think he may, counsel may have raised the issue on counterclaims being waived, but...
Now that you're talking about the witness, what's your response to his position that they didn't even know anything about the witness that the court ended up relying on fairly heavily?
Right. I believe the record shows that not to be true. Mr. Dampier filed an affidavit, or an affidavit was filed in the motion for summary judgment by Mr. Dampier. So they had knowledge that Mr. Dampier was going to be a witness in the case, was listed in the initial disclosures. They had communications with Mr. Dampier to try and negotiate the lien. So Mr. Dampier was no surprise to Mr. Mullins or his counsel that he's involved and that he would be testifying in this case. So, you know, the majority of the objections that have been lodged by Mr. Mullins or his counsel really are procedural or evidentiary in nature. And I think we've addressed those adequately in the briefs to show most of these issues come under discretion that the trial court has, or a harmless error standard. But most of the things that were just spoken about and that are addressed in the brief itself really are all about form, not substance.
Counsel, the trial court relied on four different bases and a very different basis for getting to where it got. Tell me what you think is the strongest argument on why we would affirm the position that you would like us to affirm today.
Well, I mean, you're right. The district court wrote an 85-page order, which doesn't happen often. So Judge Samore took caution to cross every T, dot every I. I think there were really two main reasons. First, the judge ruled that motion for summary judgment should have been granted. And secondly, even if that's improper, that MLM prevailed at trial.
Let's start with the summary judgment.
Sure.
Why wasn't that untimely from a procedural standpoint?
This case had lots of twists and turns. There were several discovery disputes. There were lengthy illnesses from Mr. Mullins' counsel that MLM tried to work around, and we're talking months. It is regrettable that the motion wasn't filed earlier, but the only one that was harmed by that was MLM, because it just delayed the full briefing on the motion up until trial. Mullins had a full and fair opportunity to file a response to that motion for summary judgment, and in fact even got an extension of time.
But once you tried the case, why didn't the summary judgment go away?
It did at trial. The court basically ruled, I don't have enough time to look at these issues. You're here for trial. Let's try the case. But the trial really consisted of the same issues that were addressed in the motion for summary judgment. So I don't think one is stronger than the other. I think, you know, they're really the same issues that were put before the court.
Mr. Muggy, Judge Roman asked you which of the four rationales of Judge Samore was the strongest from your perspective, and I don't think I heard an answer to that question.
Yeah, I'm not trying to sidestep any questions, Your Honor. I'm not sure that there were four.
Judge Samore said that there were four different reasons on which he was ruling in your favor. So if you're disagreeing with that, you're disagreeing with Judge Samore's characterization of his opinion.
Well, there was a motion for summary judgment. Within that, there was the judicial estoppel argument, which I think is quite strong. Other than that, the judge ruled that MLM proved its claims at trial. I'm not trying to be coy with the court here.
Judge Samore ruled that you were entitled, that MLM was entitled to summary judgment on the merits and on the basis of judicial estoppel, and those are two separate reasons. And third, he ruled that MLM was entitled to judgment on the merits at trial and also at trial on the basis of judicial estoppel. Those are the four different grounds. So is there one of them that you think is the strongest?
Well, I think they're all strong, but let's start with judicial estoppel, because I think that that is very important for this case. And the issue is, can a party take two wildly inconsistent positions in a personal injury case and an interpleader case? So I think that's, you know, the strongest issue, the strongest is the merits show that MLM is the prevailing party. The merits show, the evidence showed that Mr. Mullins breached the contract, that MLM was entitled to the money. All the evidence showed that. The evidence was uncontroverted. It was not rebutted at all. So if we want to talk about the strongest, the evidence was unrebutted that MLM is entitled to judgment. Judicial estoppel, I think, is a more important issue because it goes beyond this case, and it's just what I spoke about. Can a party take one position in the underlying personal injury case that the bills are reasonable, they were necessary, and then step next door to the courtroom and say they weren't? And it offended Judge Seymour, and I submit that it should offend every court. That's not what judicial proceedings are to be used for. They're to be used for genuine, good faith disputes on factual issues. And here, there wasn't one. Mr. Mullins always took the position that these bills were reasonable and necessary. You can't just change your tune based on the exigencies of the moment. And that's, there's Colorado case law on that. It's disrespectful of the judicial system, and it's a waste of judicial resources. I mean, here we are 5.5 years later on a case where Mr. Mullins never disagreed that the bills were reasonable and necessary. So I think that that's a very, very important issue in this case, and it's equally as strong as the merits. You know, I think the two main issues, or three main issues, we spoke about the counterclaims, but the three main issues raised on appeal by Mr. Mullins are the judicial estoppel matter, which the court detailed its analysis, found all the elements to apply here, and whether the 26A2 disclosure that was filed in the PI case and the trial management order in the PI case can be used as evidence in an interpleader action. Mr. Mullins claims that you can't use that as evidence, and I don't see any reason why that can't be. Those are public records. They were the positions taken by Mr. Mullins, so those certainly, and Judge Seymour took judicial notice of those filings. So those two documents are certainly admissible into evidence in an interpleader action. And those two documents alone should have put this whole case to rest. They showed that Mr. Mullins agreed the bills were reasonable, necessary, and causally related to his underlying accident. And then the third issue, I guess, is did MLM prevail on both the motion for summary judgment and a trial? And again, the evidence was unrebutted. There was a contract. Mr. Mullins did not perform. He received medical services, and he had to pay for them. And the only evidence that was ever submitted was that the amount of the bills were what they were, and that they were reasonable, and that they were necessary. So, Your Honors, with that, I see that my time's almost up. We requested attorney's fees in our brief, and I would renew that request here today.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honors, knowing that Mr. Muggy was going to mention it, I brought an affidavit, which is not in evidence, nor was his argument. But Mr. Mullins gave permission in 2012 to proceed with this appeal. That's my word. But getting back, the 26A2, Your Honors, Mr. Muggy did not tell you that the bill of $10,000 was not in existence at the time the 26A2 was served. The 26A2 is dated August the 23rd. The bill of $10,000 was September 7th. There can be no way the 26A2 would even prove that the bill was reasonable. And the TMO doesn't prove it either. So the 26A2, if what he says is true, why didn't he file a 26A2 in this case and say, I win? Dr. Haney testified, will testify that the bills are fair and reasonable. If you look at the 26A2, it says it is anticipated. Dr. Haney will testify. It's a witness list. A witness list cannot be used to prove a case. If it was, everyone would just say, here's my 2682, I prove my case. Secondly, there was a 2682 in the federal case. The court did not take notice of that, where the doctor said, Dr. Lander said, the bill should only be $700. And that's why the case was settled. The summary judgment, there's no affidavits in that whole summary judgment. And if you look at the disclosures, Bill Lampert was only testifying as to the signing of the lien. That's all I knew he was going to testify. We must follow the rules, Your Honor, and I've been doing this for 40 years. I follow the rules. And when you file a motion, if it's going to be late, you file the 6B2 motion, tell the court it's late. But you have, in the trial case, you have to do an expert witness, non-expert, and exhibits. Nothing was done. I was taken by surprise, and the court should have avoided that the whole trial. MLM did not prove its case in any way or any fashion. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.